Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Jan Bruce, CEO of Mequilibrium.
There was a time when there were a lot of potential competitors entering in the direct-to-consumer space, and they were raising a lot of money, which, as you know, from a tech perspective, capital and, you know, can deliver speed to build. And so there's always that temptation to, well, should we do it to get the money? But we didn't do it. And it was the right thing to do.
This is Jan. In 2011, after years in the media industry during its technological disruption, Jan witnessed firsthand how stress and resistance to change were devastating careers and organizations. And despite having no background in technology or clinical work, she made a bold decision to create a software solution when she barely understood what a software application was. For the first 5 years, she and her team worked for almost nothing, deliberately avoiding the tempting direct-to-consumer route that was attracting massive funding for competitors. We explore the counterintuitive leadership decisions that led to her company's success while competitors faltered. Her approach challenges conventional wisdom in three critical areas. Firstly, avoiding the capital trap of raising too much money too early. Secondly, resisting the temptation to pursue direct-to-consumer strategies despite industry hype. And lastly, having the patience to discover your true value proposition through customer insights rather than preconceived notions. Jan's leadership journey reveals that sometimes the most profitable path is the one where you say no to what everyone else is saying yes to. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how to achieve funding freedom by bootstrapping until investors need you more than you need them. Secondly, why saying no to popular market trends can create a sustainable competitive advantage. Thirdly, how to discover your true value proposition by listening to customers rather than industry hype. And lastly, the leadership mindset that's required to build a profitable software company when you have no technical background. Well, hi, Jan. Thank you for making the time available and being a guest on my podcast.
Hello, Tom.
Good to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's likewise. I got introduced to your company and I started reading into it and I was like, yeah, this is a person I want to have on the podcast because I believe in the same thing. It's also an area that I've been involved in and be responsible for in my own life, as well as from a product strategy perspective, HR. So that's where it's connected to. So I'm thrilled to have you on the call. Before we start talking about your company, MeQ, what drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
Well, you really have to love this work to do it consistently, right? You know, I often say to people, you're going to need a manicure every Friday because you're really going to get your nails dirty all week. And if you like that, then this is a good place to work. But for me, I think that the combination of working with smart people, bringing something new to the market and working with great customers, and then building and being out in front of change in the world is really exciting. It's exciting to do this kind of work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I feel exactly the same. There's so much opportunity, and it's been around for for a couple of decades the opportunity, but it seems like it's just getting better. And yeah, if I look back at me writing my book, deliberately putting chapter number four, trait number four, the remarkable software companies master the art of curiosity. If you build that muscle, there's so much opportunity out there.
What's interesting for me, and you may just about to ask me this, so forgive me, but I did not grow up in technology. Nor am I a clinician. So what am I doing here, right? But I did start thinking about software and SaaS businesses about 15 years ago, and kind of have never left because it's a really exciting field.
Exactly. You see a problem in the markets that where technology can help. That's powerful. I mean, particularly, I mean, I started the podcast 2018 with the when I was deliberately looking for companies that were not about automation, but about making technology and people blend in the right way so that people could become, their better self. That's also what I saw in your company, MeQ. But let's talk about what the company does and what problems it solves. When you founded the company, and I saw it was in 2011, what's the big idea behind it? What is the big problem that you saw that made you decide, okay, I'm going to solve it?
So the context for 14, 15 years ago was that I was working in media, and having come through media in the aughts, that world was imploding. And it was, I was working in an environment where, because all of the revenue streams and the way we were doing business was being disrupted by technology, it became a very stressful and toxic environment for employees. And employees who could not manage both the stress of it, but also have a mindset of being open to change, were nowhere. They've had to vastly, their careers were completely disrupted and they imploded. But
Gotcha.
people, and my aha was that we've got to have a better scalable way to help people with the stress and toxicity and need for, and all of the issues that come from constant, incessant change that are going to keep on bombarding us. Like I was at the time able to think about the fact that this isn't just a cycle that's going to be done in 24 months for media. This is going to, unless you're very, very young or about to retire, media is not going to, you don't have. You can't stay in this industry, and you have to have a different mindset. And for me, the software that, I didn't even understand what a software application was at the time, because I understood what digital media was, but not a software application. And the idea to develop an interactive approach to helping people get their head in the game and manage stress and change and psychological safety, that was the aha for MeQ. And even the idea, the very central idea of that was that in order to fix the problem, you have to understand the problem. And data and the ability to scale personalization in a mass way, it was essentially algorithm-driven therapy based on your profile. The idea of doing that was extremely novel at the time and is still very cutting edge.
So you've built quite a moat in the meantime then, like having all that knowledge about the algorithms and how to do that, how
Yes.
to apply that to people.
Yes. And I could hold my own in a meeting with a dozen technologists, even though if they were listening, they might say, well, oh, I don't know about that, Jan. No, I do know my way around 15 years later.
Of course you do. Yeah, I mean then it becomes yourself. Yeah, I mean, I saw your one of your quotes I picked up, which stuck with me, was busy is the new fine, stress is the new fat. That is, yeah, I think it sums it up. And it's not only in the media industry, but I completely agree with you that the media industry at some point, of course, was disrupted like nobody has ever seen before. And of course, a number of other industries have followed. At the end, if you look at any industry, it's all going so fast with the technology that's coming this way right now.
Right.
I mean, a year ago, I wasn't working on a day-to-day basis of Gen AI. Today, it's like 2, 3 hours of my day.
Exactly. And it's interesting to me how some people do embrace it, and some
Yeah.
people just are like, oh, it'll pass, or I'll get by without knowing enough about it.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's not only that you're using these tools, but it's changing the way that people are working. It is changing the way what's possible. It's changing the norms for people to say, hey, this was good a year ago, but now it's like, to me, this is not good enough anymore. And then just that changes everything so fast.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, starting 2011, way before AI became a big thing, what has been an early decision that appeared to be really important for your success that you have today?
Oh, that's a very interesting thing. The first big decision that we made was to avoid a direct-to-consumer approach to selling the product. And that was a lucky break for me. That was a lucky break for the company that I led because of my background in consumer media. And I understood and still believe that it was going to be years before consumers would pay significant dollars perpetually for programming that could support them. You know, especially in the US, Americans are conditioned to having their health care paid for. And they tend to put more value on tangible items that boost their health, you know, vitamins or workout clubs that they don't go to, but you know, things that could help them build up that intrinsic power, very difficult to sell. The aha in that regard was that companies, when you start to understand the cost to businesses of high stress, burnout, mental health costs that are the longer term manifestation of high stress and burnout, and then also the cost to businesses in terms of what I call lack of adaptive capacity, the inability of people to understand that they must change, or they must adopt new business practices to survive. Once you start tallying up those costs for businesses, it's so much more effective. The ROI to the business is far greater than the individual's impetus to buy this for him or herself. So that was, you know, that was something that was an early on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it goes back to the good old principle, you know. If people invest in something, it needs to be valuable to them. It needs to be on the one side also critical, otherwise it's a nice to have. And for a business, yeah, like you say, it exponentially increases when something happens to the same person. Privately and business-wise, it has a completely different mindset. I like that. And I completely agree also, like the moment you choose B2C, no, B2B, yes, that also changes a lot for how you go about developing the solution. So what was a
By the way, there were tricky aspects to that. There was a time when there were a lot of potential competitors entering in the direct-to-consumer space, and they were raising a lot of money, which, as you know, from a tech perspective, capital and, you know, can deliver speed to build. And so there's always that temptation to, well, should we do it to get the money? But we didn't do it, and it was the right thing to do.
Oh, tell me, because I saw that you raised, I think, 9 million at some point. When was that moment? And so far, how long have you been bootstrapping?
Well, we have raised money. We have raised three rounds of capital in our 14, 15 years. But compared to many of the other vendors in the industry, we have been extremely capital efficient. The company's profitable.
Let me make a small interruption here. Jen just made an excellent remark that sets her leadership approach apart from conventional startup wisdom. The realization that capital efficiency gives you more options that overfunded competitors don't have. That change not only leads to immediate business discipline, but also creates long-term strategic freedom to pursue what actually works rather than what investors demand. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They focus on the essence, challenging everything that doesn't move the needle. They master the art of curiosity, reading signals better than competitors. And they acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And I think each step of the way, there were, a whole other conversation, but there are definitely, checkpoints in terms of product market fit, customer acquisition, and customer retention that lead you to the ability to raise capital at different times in your history. And we did that as well.
Yeah. So what, until what point were you bootstrapped?
We were pretty lean for a number of years. Yeah, until for the first 5 years, we were, we had people on our team who had been very successful in more of a corporate environment from a financially, they were making a lot of money. And we were all working, for almost nothing until we got enough critical mass of customers and revenue and clout that we could basically raise the capital and start delivering salaries. And even though we're a growth company now, I'm not sure that our salaries and our benefits match dollar for dollar what you might get, at a Microsoft or something like that, some company like
Totally
that.
different conversation at the end. But what always inspires me is that companies that do go for the bootstrap route, what you did is to get to that point where you say, okay, yes, we have product market fit. Yes, we have customers that are willing to pay and also stay. And we get the company. If without capital, we're profitable and we can go on like this. So now it's an option.
That's right. Optionality is very important.
Exactly. I call it getting towards the stage of funding freedom, that you don't have
Yeah.
to desperately chase funding because you need the funding to stay alive. That's a
That's
completely
right.
different ballgame. And then it's beneficial for everybody. You have choices. I like that. So talking about your choice B2C, not to go B2C. Obviously in the B2B space, you're gonna also have competitors. Because I mean, I know how busy the HRs technology spaces, the HCM space. How have you approached that whole thing of standing out, competitive differentiation?
Well, that what's interesting is that we have a very clear differentiation. And the reason I'm very sort of adamant or very confident about that is that if you ask our customers will all tend to say the same thing. And one of the just a little story, if I may. I was on the main stage of a big HR event about 4 or 5 years ago and with a customer of ours. And it was one of those situations where there's Q&A from the audience and some wise guy raised his hand and asked my customer the question, well, if MeQ weren't here today, tomorrow, what would happen? What would you miss? And what would you do? Do you have anything else that could replace it? And I was like, oh, someone's really trying to make trouble for me. Must be from a he must work for a competitor of ours, right? And our customer, without missing a beat, said, There are lots of fine products out there, lots of products that help with resilience and helping with employee engagement and well-being. But without MeQ, we would be flying blind. We would have no dashboard of what's going on with our people because nobody is able to give us such a view of what's going on with our people with regards to, psychosocial risk, burnout, mental health risks, productivity, and then also well-being. So well stratified and segmentable that we can actually use it to figure out what to do about our problems. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's our value prop. There's lots of companies out there that do a great job helping employees when they raise their hand because they're feeling depressed or they need an executive coach or something like that. But there's no one who does as good a job as we do at understanding and giving you a view of your organization and the hot spots and what to do about it. And of course, we can address those problems for you too. But that, getting that level of understanding and hearing your customers say it is, sort of, it's very good validation.
Yeah, it's remarkable. It's, no, yeah, I completely agree. And that well articulated, it's, yeah, then everybody's quiet and says, okay, yeah, if that's important to you and it's important to many, then that's the thing to have. Because indeed, you're right. You know, when people are raising their hand, there's always technology available for helping them. But it's the majority don't raise their hand.
That's right. They don't. And that's where these problems, I mean, I know it when I started the company. I was there. When you talk about the other side, the personal aha side of MeQ for me was that I understood in an environment of, incessant change and stress and toxicity, my own personal goals about achievement and success and control were, how were they hindered by my own mindset and my own ability to handle stress? And I kind of said, wow, I'm in the business. Like, what about everyone else? That was really, really important to,
Sure.
to understand. So it's been a very effective, it's been the real impeller of this business.
And what I like about how you approach it is you've been digging into the problem much, possibly much deeper than others, you know, where others solve symptoms or maybe, yeah, like it's, I think it's symptom solving where you went, okay, what is the core here? And if people don't speak up, how can we still make it visible?
To your point, these are insidious problems. I barely understood them in myself. And that's what I meant to say. But most people, they get acclimated to stress and toxic environments, toxic cultures. They get acclimated to feeling burned out or not having energy, and they just think that's normal. You get conditioned to that. And that's where you don't raise your hand and say, I need help. You say to yourself, oh, everyone feels that way. But
True.
that's where the data can be so important because we can identify who needs help and we don't want to single people out. I don't mean that, but we have lots of tools that can help teams, teams that are above the norm in burnout or productivity impairment, and we can help managers deal with those teams. And then individually, if we understand that you are at risk for something like anxiety or burnout, as a member of MeQ, all of the programming is personalized and targeted to support you. So it's very effective.
Yeah. And on the one hand side, it's about, yeah, preventing the bad things from happening, the stress to occur less, the burnout to happen not at all. But what I also see your on your website and in the communication that I've read so far, of course, it's also about the upside.
That's
Like
right.
what you actually can do to become that top performer or to become, resilient in your job. And I deliberately went on when I heard the word resilience or read the word resilience because I'm writing a second book about it. So how
Oh,
is that
that's great. We
happening?
should talk about that.
We do. No, but the resilience at the end is, everybody performs better if they become more resilient to what is happening because you don't have everything under control.
Right.
So how do you go about that? I mean, at what point in the life cycle of the product? Because what I've sort of assume is that it started with preventing the bad, but.
Well, that's not okay. So we started the company with IP, intellectual property, around developing resilience in people. You know, there was a science-backed approach that we basically created a, you know, a license for. That we have that is now our proprietary IP, which was perfected about 20 years ago, identifying the characteristics of resilient behaviors, what makes some people resilient and other people not, and then training people so that they can be more resilient. And the learning of the initial studies was that this is not personality driven. This is not genetic. It is incontrovertible that these are skills that can be acquired. And people tend to develop their initial levels of resilient behaviors in early childhood, watching what grown-ups do. So if they grow up with people who tend to blame everything on everyone else, if they grow up with people who let their emotions cloud reality, if they grow up with people who are negative, and you know, things like that, that rubs off on you and that becomes your way of navigating the world. But we can change it. And that's what MeQ does. Starting, but first we have to understand your wiring, right? And that's what I mean about the data-driven approach. And then we can upskill you to be stronger. And some of the typical things that we do, but what we learned early on, let me jump to that, is that the more resilient you become, the better you manage stress and adversity, and the more you are capable of building positive skills to succeed. So it's not just dialing down the bad, it's dialing up the good. And a really good example of that would be learning how to prioritize what's important to you and not pay attention to what is slowing you down. Like that's an aspect of resilience, whereas people get caught up in everything. They focus on the bad, or they try to control everything, or they try to succeed at everything, and then they end up falling short. But if you just focus on achieving or succeeding with what's really important to you and lose the rest of it, you can become very successful.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. You just talked about, okay, I mean, the word personal came about a number of times now. I mean, today, the whole thing of co-pilots and assistants and so on is becoming very common. I think it's for a good thing. So I wonder, when you started in 2011 and you started to get the first product to market, and you went to the companies that you thought, okay, would be helped by that. How have you gone about? What have you learned from your first 100 customers? Was there a lot of a pushback, objections, like this is not going to work, whatever? Or did you already get in the beginning these people that got it?
No, it was a mixed bag. What was really interesting, you know, 10 years ago was really when we started to go to market, was that there are many customers in HR that still had not yet understood the ramifications of, you know, continual stress on people. They were like, "Well, what do you mean? That's not a problem," or "I
They
don't
don't
get that."
know.
They don't understand that. That's changed. I mean, I think the pandemic did a lot. The whole connection between stress and burnout and mental health and the cost to the employer got a lot clearer in the pandemic. It also got clear as labor shortages, accelerated. So we need our people. There's not this endless pool of skilled labor that we can bring in. So those forces have provided kind of tailwinds for us for what we do. So there were those doubters, skeptics. Do I really need this? But what we, the customers, the early customers were actually responsible for showing us the real value prop of what we do. Because once they got past the amazing, sort of innovation of personalizing training for people based on, their sort of root cause, their psychometric profile, so to speak. What they really seized on was the data, the insights that the aggregate of everyone's data de-identified could give them to the business. There was literally a day when a customer said to me, "You had me at this heat map of my team. It's like I've never seen anything like that." And so that became the tail wagging the dog of our business. That became the unique value and differentiator of MeQ. The fact that we could give the customer a view of what's going on with their people and then systematically address those problems.
Yeah, true. Yeah, exactly. That's yeah, it's always fascinating when you get an aha moment. You know that you get my daily email, and one thing that I spent a lot of time on the last month, I think, was the whole notion of the predictability of the business. You've been around now for 10 years. At what point did you start to see that it became more predictable in terms of what you do? You go to market, you meet customers. Your sort of knowledge about, okay, yes, these will buy and these will not buy. At what point was that?
I would say about 7 years into
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it takes that time.
think 5 to 7 years. I mean,
Yeah.
don't you think? I think that young companies think they know, but they don't really. I think there's always a tendency, you're dealing with a very small universe of customers and you think you know, but it evolves.
Yeah,
But I
true.
really think that, when you get a critical mass of customers and sellers is when you can really start to understand that. And I think that was maybe about 5 years into it. Maybe let's talk about that. Let's say that,
Yeah.
not seven, but five.
And what changed it? Or what was it, the aha moment you say, hey, okay, this is that sweet spot. And
I
how have you
think
acted on that?
I don't think we instantly understood that the insights for I think that we continued to focus on things like stress is the new fat and stress is the problem for a while until we were able to connect the dots that it's the data and it's the ability. We have MeQ has kind of a flywheel going, value creation flywheel with the ability to get quality differentiated data that drives personalization. And that actually is part of the reason the engagement is so good, because people understand that we understand them. And that means we have more engagement and we have happy customers, and then we get more customers, and then there's more data, and the algorithms get better. And, every time you get a new industry and you start to become more relevant in an industry, then it creates an opportunity to get more customers in the industry. So that's what happens.
So if you look back at the last 10 years then, what would you do differently if you had to rebuild the company from, well, today?
Oh, that's so interesting. There's always things you can do differently.
Maybe you did things the right way.
Well, I think we did a lot of things right. I probably would have invested more quickly in the data structures.
The data across customers, the data within the companies, it tells you so much. And so many software companies sit on that gold mine and don't do anything with it. There are plenty of examples of that.
I would have done that more quickly.
So you already mentioned there were a couple of those sort of moments, pivot moments in the markets, like COVID was one of them. And I mean the popularity of AI. A number of things changed. Which one has been most beneficial, and maybe another one, which one has been most riskful for your business?
So I think that there were probably lots of those, hype situations in the first 5 to 10 years, five, 6 years. I'm trying to remember some of the, I mean, I think the one we avoided was the go consumer craze. Because, a lot of companies were getting very high valuations because they had a B2B and a B2C, direct to consumer and a enterprise SaaS approach. And they were perceived as, and I just didn't see it. The co customer acquisition costs in direct to consumer businesses are difficult, are expensive, and can consume a lot of your capital. And I also worried about channel conflict with the enterprise. So we avoided that pitfall, although it was very tempting a number of times. I think the pandemic was probably the most positive, whatever you called it, event that, that drove business, because a lot of companies aren't facing a problem that started in the pandemic, which is that people don't show up for work. I mean, look at our nursing industry. People don't show up, or they quit, and the cost to replace them, or the cost to carry an extra 20% of workers on your payroll to avoid, being understaffed is expensive. So customers, that really drove home the economic, financial need to address these problems. And that was very good for our business, because customers were wanting, they definitely wanted to evaluate solutions that could help them. And that was great. I think that the latest trend right now is that, and this happens all the time in SaaS programming, the things that you think are really differentiated become table stakes. And you have to be careful for that, because you train your people and you don't, the waste, the problem is they're out talking about things that no one, that everyone already has or everyone else already does, and that's not impactful. And I feel right now that the SaaS, technology, HR technology has gotten a little bit less shiny, less exciting for HR. I feel like HR, buyers bought a lot of product. There's a big problem of over-vendoring and suboptimal utilization. And customers are saying, we don't, before we buy anything, we have to see what we've got and why doesn't it work and blah, 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 blah. So that means to me, it's sort of like, I wouldn't call it like, are you familiar with the Gartner hype cycles? It's not exactly like a trough of disillusionment, but there's a little bit of that going on there. And so for us, the learning was, well, what we see a lot of customers looking for, well, maybe it shouldn't be purely SaaS. Maybe there's like a tech-enabled services approach that would be, because human to human is so exciting, but how scalable is that actually? What are the margins of that? So what we have found is that the better data, our positioning has evolved because we want to be that system of intelligence for you that helps you understand when to bring in, tech-enabled services and when to use technology and how to make your ecosystem more efficient. So that has been kind of an evolution made possible by the strength of our data.
Yeah, and of course also about how the market has evolved. Let me see, looking at the time. Two more
Yes.
questions. You mentioned table stakes. Solutions are there, they are differentiated, but as time evolves and technology evolves and the customer norms evolve, certain things turn down into table stakes and others maybe not. How do you keep your people aware, or how do you keep them curious to that, or keep their eyes open to that? Because what I wrote about it in my book as well, it's this whole disease of complacency. You're
Yeah.
doing fine, you know, but in the meantime, you're not. But of course, as an entrepreneur, you have to be aware of that because changing it takes time.
That's right. So, well, first of all, we have some tools at our disposal at MeQ because we have really good ways of understanding,
Change.
how you're wired. And MeQ, we have a lot of change embracers in our company. And some of the things that we are doing, they are not sitting. I mean, they are the employees at MeQ are pushing AI development, so rapidly. And without, it's not like that we're saying figure it out. They're kind of running in saying, look what we can do. I mean, we have a they built a proprietary, Gen AI model, they started 3 years ago, and we have launched a Ask MeQ Gen
Right.
AI driven approach that allows people to ask questions in our app, and basically it can give you, if you're like saying I'm feeling kind of stressed out right now, and I have a meeting in 15 minutes, we can help you with that. If you work in a call center and you can't. You can't leave your desk. We can help you in one way versus if you're a manager, we can help you in another way. So we
Cool.
have used AI to help the product scale make it better, like Ask MeQ for managers. But
Yeah.
we are also using it to help our customers understand their data better, the
Yeah.
buyers.
Yeah.
Because Gen AI can kind of say in a minute, in three paragraphs, explain what continued burnout in this call center is going to do for your customer satisfaction scores. And, in a year from now, we might be able to put a dollar figure on that based on what the salaries of those employees in that organization make, because we have a lot of data. So
So much opportunity.
it's very anonymized, but it's still there.
So yeah, so much opportunity at the end, and it comes with the curiosity again. Last question. If you think of a do and a don't, based on what you've learned in the last 11 years, that the advice that you would give to peers, people that aspire to build a company as successful as yours, what would it be?
I would say the learning on the do is have the confidence and conviction to pursue your idea. Because people are going to, it's a minefield out there. People are going to be, they're going to knock it down. They're going to make it difficult. They're always going to say why you can't, but focus on what you think. And don't raise too much money until you know what you're doing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Jan. Fascinating story. I could talk for another 2, 3 hours with you. Good luck on the next part of the journey. And where can people go to find out more about the company? The last question
Oh,
then.
they can go to mequilibrium.com.
Yeah. Okay. And how to say, how to find you, how to say hi to
And
you.
I am Jan at mequilibrium.com.
Okay, cool. Thank you for
Thank
sharing
you.
that. Bye.
Take care.
And this ends my conversation with Jan, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Jan Bruce, founder and CEO of MeQuilibrium. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.